Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Craig Kaplan. Craig is the founder and CEO of IQ Company. He's also the founder of superintelligence.com. Craig, welcome to the podcast.
Christian, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. As we were just chatting before we kick things off, man, there's a lot to talk about. And especially given the focus on AI, super excited to have you on. But if we can, let's start with IQ Company. Would love to learn more about the firm and what your focus is.
Sure. I started IQ Company in 1993. So we've been around for a while as a consulting firm focused on information technology. And basically, we've been building intelligence systems for 30 plus years. And kind of the special niche is collective intelligence systems that take input from millions of people, or these days, people and AI, and then sort of coordinate the input to solve problems. So that's kind of the past. And super intelligence is all about the future of AI, and in particular, how do we make it safer for humanity?
So congrats on the success you've had with IQ Company. I mean, to be around that long, I presume you're doing a lot of things right. Interesting to hear, though, the emphasis on safety. It's a topic that I personally read about on a regular basis, but I admit I don't give it as much thought per se, but I realize it's an important topic. You know, for the benefit of our audience, can you give a little bit of color as to why that subject is top of mind?
Sure. So I've been working in the field of AI for a long time, since the mid 80s. I did my graduate work at Carnegie Mellon with Herbert Simon, who is a Nobel Prize winner, Turing Award winner, and one of the 11 scientists that invented or named the field in 1956. So he was like almost 70. I was 21, right, when we met. And we worked together. It was a really great experience. We co-authored research. And what I found is generally the people that have been in the field for a long time, 30, 40 years, they have a much better sense of this is a tremendously exciting technology, but also there's some dangers associated with it in the longer term. And I think most of us, probably your listeners and me as well, we're very focused on what can we do with our businesses, and this is great, and you know, AI agents, and wow, you know, I can use Gemini and Claude and GPT, and I can get all this stuff done, and one coder or one employee or contractor can do the work of 10 people. So there's all this exciting stuff going on. But if you sort of step back and zoom out, I think there's some other issues, because we're used to thinking of just new tools and new technologies that supercharge us. Mm-hmm. But AI is a little bit different. It's actually not just a tool, it's an intelligent entity, or it's becoming an intelligent entity. And so it's something unprecedented. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about it, but it's very different than sort of the other technology changes that we've had in the past, the internet and cloud and all those kinds of things.
Your assessment, I think, is spot on. Had a weekly leadership call today, and almost every single member of the team was commenting of how much they got done over the holiday break. For our benefit of our audience, we're recording this the first week in January. And it's true, myself included. I mean, what would historically take me, you know, days or weeks, I was able to complete in hours. And yes, productivity is top of mind, but I don't necessarily think of Skynet. And so maybe that's just a great starting point, because, you know, I think that's in our society, maybe what a lot of people think about. If AI reaches superintelligence, what is that? What's the implication for us? And, you know, is there a conflict?
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe one way to think of it is the progression. And if we don't have to go all the way back to 1956, but if we look at the last few years, let's just say November of 2022, ChatGPT, right around Thanksgiving, that was really the inflection point. it sort of burst into people's consciousness that there are these things called large language models that we can interact with. And wow, they seem almost intelligent, or sometimes they hallucinate and make things up, but in general, pretty good. And so the next sort of baby step from there, the next step has really been AI agents. AI agents is taking something like a large language model and giving it a little bit of autonomy and equipping it with some tools so it can go do things on your behalf, right? So that's good. But still, the human is sort of in control. The human is setting guardrails and limits, and we're training the system. So nothing to be too scared about yet. But if you look at sort of the rate at which the capability and the power, the information processing capability of these systems is improving, it's on the order of 10x a year, right? We just had CES in Las Vegas. Jensen Huang, head of NVIDIA, gets up on stage and he's like, 10x, he's now on a once a year cadence with the chips, right? And he's looking for that 10x improvement every year. And if it's, maybe a bad year, maybe it's 5x or something. But still, that level of sort of compounding improvement in processing power means that in just a few years, you're going to have systems that, can think a lifetime worth of human thoughts in the time that you and I sort of think one or two thoughts, right? So that's a huge discrepancy in computational power. If in addition to that, you have systems that are autonomous, they can make decisions, set goals on their own, then all of a sudden it becomes really important that those systems, sort of at a high level, are generally aligned with the same goals as humans. And that's what, when people in AI safety or just AI researchers in general sometimes talk about the alignment problem. That's the issue of, will these advanced intelligences care about the same things that humans care about? Will they have positive human values? And that's kind of the end game. Everyone's focused on the productivity boosts, and it's amazing. I love AI, right? I mean, I've devoted my entire life to it. So this is my favorite subject, and I am thrilled at the amount of work, just like you said, that we can get done. But when I go out, 5+ years, I realize that this is not really a tool. What's happening is we're having a technology that's more like an intelligent entity. It's closer to an alien intelligence than it is a tool. And this alien intelligence will be thousands of times smarter and faster than us, and it will set its own goals, and it will be autonomous. And so at that point, it's really important that it is positive. It has, positive values and wants the best for us. And there's no guarantee that that will happen. So it has to be designed properly. So this is the thing, Jeff Hinton, who used to be at Google, won the Nobel Prize recently, is basically devoted his life. He invented the core technology that everything's running on. He's basically spending all of his time telling people, hey guys, this is great, but there's some danger. And I'm sort of another one joining the chorus and trying to provide some solutions so that things don't sort of, get out of hand. We have a window of opportunity to do the design correctly. And, 5 years from now, it's going to be a lot harder to do that.
Okay, super exciting. I want to ask about sentience. Before I do, just given our audience consists of a lot of non-technical founders and investors, can you unpack LLMs for us from a layman's perspective? My understanding, it's a predictive model. It's anticipating what the answer is based on the underlying data set. But I also understand that that's just maybe on the surface, and that the power of the model also depends on how it's trained, how it's rewarded, so that as it makes mistakes or doesn't give the right answer, it can learn. Is that a cursory assessment? And if so, can you give us a little bit more insider knowledge, please?
Sure. Yeah. All that is more or less correct. It's a good basic understanding of it, I think. I'll say a couple things, and then you can tell me if you want me to go deeper or zoom out a little bit. So if you think about the human brain is basically a bunch of neurons, and all of our knowledge is encoded in the connections between these neurons. It's kind of the strength of one neuron to another. And then when some stimulus comes in, it triggers, and then that spreads, the activation spreads to other neurons. And all of that is the sort of physiological basis for how our brains work and for human intelligence. What happened in really the mid 80s, was this innovation. It was a shift in the field of AI from 1956 till 1980. Everything was, let's just program in rules into a computer, and maybe we can have artificial intelligence, but we will know exactly what the AI knows because we programmed everything in. Machine learning was this new idea that really began to get traction in the mid-80s, and it said, hey, maybe there's an easier way. We don't program rules into human brains. We just, you know, show them, expose them to data, and then these connections, the weights between the neurons get formed. These connections get formed. What if we built a model that kind of worked that same way? And that's basically large language models. It's like a giant matrix of, you know, essentially artificial neurons, and you feed it a whole bunch of data, and then there's an algorithm, and the algorithm strengthens or weakens connections between those neurons. And that's what people sometimes refer to as the weight matrix or whatever. And so when people say there's like a 600 billion parameter model or something, it's kind of like there's 600 billion connections between these artificial neurons that have been trained by exposing it to lots of information, typically that's publicly available on the internet, and saying, you know, when somebody asks this question, this is kind of the common response on the internet. And so it says, oh, okay, I can associate this stimulus with this response. And initially, it's kind of like the, you know, if you were in school and there were two types of learners, there's the one who just memorized everything, and then the test came and they could sort of regurgitate it back, and they might do really well on the test, but they didn't really understand the deep principles. They just kind of memorized it. That's kind of like the early large language models that we had from 2022, 2023. They were really great at memorizing, almost infinite memory, right? Huge amounts of memory. Imagine if you knew everything on the internet. Somewhere in there, when a certain question is asked, there's a response that you've been shown. And because you're one of these geniuses on just memorizing everything, you're able to generate that kind of knowledge. But it's not really a deep understanding. And what's happened in the last couple of years, sort of the evolution from the large language models like ChatGPT that was initially released, people are now talking about reasoning models and thinking models. And so there's a certain response you can get where you just, you know, put in a prompt or stimulus, and then there's the automatic response. But if it's a more complicated problem that might require a sequence of steps, well, I'll try this, and then next I'll do this, and then after that I'll do this, and depending on what happens, maybe I'll do that. You know, this sequential reasoning, that is not going to be work very well with a system that just memorizes a bunch of stuff, because you can't memorize every possible answer to problems. Not every problem is out there. You have to be able to reason through things. And so the techniques for doing that reasoning have been around in AI for a long time. And what's happened in the last couple of years is people have said, okay, let's take that huge memorization capability, that large language capability, and let's add some reasoning on top of it. And now we can really kind of take off, because we can solve problems that we've never seen before. It doesn't have to be that the answer is in the internet and we are retrieving it. It's more like we can kind of step our way through it. That's just beginning to happen. It's going to happen more and more. And then the next step after that, and that's where AI agents come in, right? Because AI agents, you give them a little autonomy and you give them some reasoning skills, and they can all of a sudden go off and do tasks on your behalf, kind of like an intern or somebody who's sort of a beginner employee, entry-level employee. And then the next step, which has not quite happened yet, but if people are looking for investment or what's going to happen next, I think you'll begin to see this year and probably next 18 months, a huge sort of investment and deployment of systems for coordinating many agents. It's the coordination of those agents. Because first you get them, you personalize them, you have one assistant, but pretty soon you're going to have like an army of them. How do you put them together and how do you coordinate that activity? Just like with a team, you would coordinate a bunch of people that are working together on a team. Here it's going to be, what's the architecture and the methods for coordinating lots of AI agents?
100% what you're talking about. And just by sheer coincidence, you know, our firm is actually working down that road. So a big focus of ours is accounting and finance. We're working towards a 0-day close. A lot of people don't appreciate that, you know, QuickBooks for sake of online, for sake of example, is just one component of a broader accounting and finance stack. And that you have to have it talk to your CRM, your payment engine, perhaps a proprietary database. And so Totally makes sense that you're going to require some middleware that can coordinate agents within the core stack. I want to come back to this evolution. And so, as I mentioned, we're, for benefit of our audience, we're recording this the first week of 2026. And Yann LeCun, who recently stepped down as the lead at Meta, made a comment in an interview that LLMs may not lead to superintelligence. If you're familiar with the interview, would love for you to either comment on it or maybe help connect the dots with the reasoning feedback that you gave us, and if that's where he was going to get to superintelligence.
Sure. Yeah. So Yann LeCun, very smart researcher, used to be, kind of the head of AI at Meta. And now there's been a changing of the guard, right? Alexander Wang came in as heading up their superintelligence group. And I think Yann is off to Paris or something and doing a startup. Super smart guy. I think, and I don't know the exact reference you're talking to, but in general, I've seen him talk along the lines of, kind of what we can get from power laws of just, which basically means just throwing more data at training these systems and more CPUs, right? That's been all the success in recent years, certainly the last 3 years. These models get smarter and smarter, right? If you're using GPT today versus GPT in 2022, it's a big difference. You can really tell the difference. And all of the increase in intelligence has been basically, let's use the same old algorithms that we already had, transformer algorithms and some other ones that are those machine learning algorithms. And let's put more and more data in and let's run it through more and more GPUs, more processors for longer. And what that allows you to do is build basically a bigger parameter model. You can train up more connections in those neurons. So we're going to have bigger and bigger brains with more and more connections by doing the same old thing. And that's worked fantastically. It's you can plot it on a graph, and people say you can almost predict if I double the data and I put in 10 times more compute power and I do it train it longer, I will be able to train 10 times more parameters and I will get this boost in intelligence. And it's been just like with Moore's law, it's not an actual law, but it's describing something. It's described very well the increase in intelligence. What Jan is saying is, hey, we're reaching a ceiling here. We're not going to be able to keep doing that. We're maybe running out of data, real world data. Now, there's of course the idea of synthetic data where AI generates its own data that is not really on the internet. So we'll put that to the side. But there is sort of this issue we might run out of data. And it may be that we're just sort of squeezing everything we can out of that one data set now. And you're not going to continue to get these huge increases in intelligence. And so therefore, this approach, maybe not a dead end, but it's going to slow down and it's not going to be enough to get to super intelligence. And super intelligence, we could define, people define it different ways, but you could say a system that can do anything, any cognitive task that people can do way better than people, like a thousand times better or something. So it may not be enough to get there. So then you need like a different approach. How do we, what else can we do with AI to make it better? I actually agree with that. I mean, I don't know. It's an open question. Nobody knows. The researchers don't know whether or not these scaling laws are going to hit a ceiling or not. There's speculation. Some people say yes, some people say no. You can sort of cite evidence on either side that makes your case. But we'll find out in the next, 2, 3 years if that's really happening, if it's really slowing down. So far, it hasn't. Jan is pointing out that there may be other ways to design these systems and train these systems to get to the really most advanced kind of intelligence, super intelligence. I agree with that. That's what we do at superintelligence.com. I mean, I've been inventing and designing intelligence systems for 20 years. So I'm very comfortable in this area. And we have basically taken an approach that we call like democratic AI. So instead of having one large language model that you train with more and more data and more power, and it becomes this super genius, let's have a whole community. And it's many minds are better than one. It's a collective intelligence approach. And it says each individual entity, whether it's a large language model or a human, doesn't need to be a super genius. You can just be kind of okay. But together in aggregate, if you coordinate them in the right way, the community itself will be smarter than anything on the planet and any other AI system. So that's a different approach. That's a design, a democ and I call it democratic AI because Going back to the earlier point about values, you want each of these entities that are working together to make this very powerful intelligence to represent the values of individual humans, their owners, I think. And in that way, you get a very broad sort of representation of human values. And when there's conflicts, they can vote and use democratic ways to resolve it. So kind of like a democracy functions, like the overall democracy, you know, it's definitely not perfect, but it's doing a decent job. We haven't killed everybody yet. We're getting things done. And it kind of represents, you know, lots of different human viewpoints. I think that's a much more sort of robust and resistant to bad actor kind of design than having one giant LLM. You don't know how it operates, because that's another problem. They're big black boxes. And the value system was programmed in by five people at OpenAI or some Silicon Valley firm. And they're making the decisions for 8 billion people. That just doesn't sit right for me. I think it really should be more representative. And it will actually, I think, be a faster, profitable, and more powerful system if you design it that way.
So said another way, anyone who's using an LLM needs to be aware that there could be bias built into the results given the source.
Yes.
And in order to address that bias, we're looking for solutions, whether it's democratization or other, to at least make sure that, you know, people are aware that they're, you know, being humans. We have opinions on interpreting information.
Absolutely. There's a whole issue, this question of AI bias. So here's an example that makes it fairly concrete. So let's say you're building a large language model, an AI system in the legal area. And you want it to treat, you know, everybody fairly, no racism, no prejudice or whatever. If you do something as simple as like, just go back and find all the court records from the 1800s on up and load that all in to say, okay, I want you to learn all these precedents, which is a common thing. That's a classic way that you would train a system, is get all the data you can, feed it in and have it learn all that stuff. There's inherent biases in those court records, right? Because some of them were, you know, way back before civil rights and everything, and it's going to learn all that stuff. And so then you ask this trained up LLM that's supposed to be this legal expert, and it starts coming out with racist comments and everything else. Well, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out, but you didn't think it was garbage. You thought those were legitimate, you know, very reputable court records, but actually it had biases. So that's just an example of how biases can get into these systems. Whatever data you put in, you have to be very careful about it, because you're basically telling the AI, this is what I want you to learn. Right.
It sounds like an objective framework is needed, kind of as like a rule book that everyone can work off of, so that they understand when they're looking at a model, what are the, you know, non-subjective ways that it's making decisions or interpretations and sharing that information.
Yeah, that would be helpful. It's really tricky to do. It's what I've come to is it's kind of like in society. Ideally, you'd say, I wish, you know, here's the set of, you know, ethical and good behavior for society. And you could have one person or a small group come up with it. But then that's going to reflect their biases and their culture and kind of their experience. And so kind of the messier, but in some ways, the best that we've got is to say, let's decentralize it and let's have it be a democracy. Let's have everybody. You're going to have people that have really bad values, just like people do hate speech and different. But on average, if you really include millions of people, the average is going to be pretty good. It's going to be, you know, don't kill other people. You know, maybe there's different religions and everything else, but, you know, there's going to be wide agreement on certain basic human values, and it will be very robust. And then in different countries, you know, maybe it'll be skewed more towards the culture or the value system in that country. So I think a design that includes values from as many people as possible and, you know, ethics from as many people as possible is probably the most robust and the one that I would advocate. It's not being what's being done now. What's being done now is you have a few leading tech companies, and some people talk about there's something called constitutional AI, where you write up a list of what's right and what's wrong. But who's coming up with that list? It's like, you know, 10, 20 something programmers at one of these tech firms who don't have the life experience that you and I have, or certainly don't reflect the values of other countries. And So even if they're well-intentioned, which I think they are, I just think a more democratic, very decentralized approach would be better.
Well, I, and I also, it makes complete sense. And I think you also said it earlier is that, if everything operates in a black box, it's very difficult to discern whether or not the results are biased. And so what's, best disinfected is shining a light. We can get transparency, gets us a really long way. And then to your point, if we can smooth out the fat tails by just making the middle of the distribution as big as possible, it's got to help. Makes good sense.
Yes. And you actually are hitting on probably one of the key safety concerns for the long run, which is this lack of transparency, this opaqueness. So this is the trade-off. This was the bargain that was made with machine learning. So we talked about machine learning was this easy way. Instead of doing it the hard way where you had to program in a rule for every piece of knowledge that the AI would have. And you could imagine that would take forever to try to cover all of human knowledge, right? Which is why the early approach to AI from the 1950s up to 1980 kind of ran into a dead end. It couldn't get past a certain point. It could play chess because you could play program in rules for chess, or it could do narrow things. But when you tried to get it to do anything that a human could, no way, it wasn't going to go. And there were researchers that literally devoted their careers and had an army of graduate students, and all they were doing is trying to code in all this stuff, and they just couldn't get there. So they said, all right, let's give up on that. Let's do machine learning. We won't try to code in the information ourselves. We'll just let the system learn it. But the flip side of that is nobody, including the researchers that invented those algorithms, nobody knows what it's learning. You don't know what it's learning. It's just like with a person. I can teach you and show you stuff, but I can't get inside your head and know exactly what you've learned. I can look at your behavior and sort of guess about what you might have learned, but I can't read your mind. And similarly, with these AIs, nobody knows where the information is encoded. They know there's 600 billion parameters, but they don't know which parameter corresponds to what. And it's because of the way that the system learned. It just learned it all, at light speed with all of these huge data centers. And it's impossible for humans to really understand that. That means you have a giant black box. And the giant black box nature of it is the reason that they hallucinate, make things up, and behave in unpredictable ways. And that's okay if they're going to read an email or summarize it and they say 2 + 2 = 5 every now and then, which they don't do too often, but they used to in 2022. I have a video showing, hey, I can get it to say 2 rabbits + 2 rabbits = 6 rabbits or whatever, and it'll do it with great confidence. So they make mistakes like that. And you can't look into the brain to see where it is. All you can do is give it feedback and say, don't do this, don't do that. So that's not transparent. And it's inherently unsafe. It's inherently unsafe. It's okay now, but if you now say that thing is 1,000 times smarter than you and, in 2 seconds can think a lifetime worth of your thoughts and it has autonomy, do you really want to have it be a black box? I don't think so. So you need transparency, just as you said. Okay, there's an answer. It's a problem, but here's the answer. One of the answers, or one approach to answer this question. In a democracy, I do not need to know what's in Christian's brain, and Christian doesn't need to know what's in Craig's brain. I just need to look at what you say and what your actions are. And the democracy has rules for governing the interaction of the agents. So when you take an action, it becomes transparent. When you say something, it becomes transparent. And then we have rules that say these things are okay to do and these things aren't. And so you've got transparency and you've got the rules, and it's pretty safe. I don't really worry about you destroying the entire world, and you don't worry about me doing that. If we designed advanced AI in that same way, in a democratic collective intelligence approach, each of the agents can be a black box. But when it does something, when it says something to any of the other agents, or to humans, that becomes transparent. You can now see what it's doing, and you can have rules governing the way these things work together. So that would bring transparency to the system at the level where they interact with each other. And if the really high level of intelligence, if the super intelligence comes from the interaction, many minds better than one, then you'll have the super intelligent system where you can see all the little inputs and the interactions in a transparent way that are leading to that super intelligence. That means you can have ethical rules, you can have safety rules, you can have predictability. You've gone a long way to solving that problem. The thing is, the dominant way of building these systems, because it's easy, is the one that Jan LeCun doesn't like, which is let's just train them with more and more data and more and more things. Everyone does it because it's easy and because it's been working pretty well, and all they need is money. Throw 10 more billion at it, we can buy some more GPUs, and we're pretty sure it'll be smarter, and then we can sell it. But they're not paying attention to the fact that they're building a bigger black box. And if you keep building bigger and bigger black boxes, eventually the black box is smarter than you, and you have no idea how it's going to work. So your design for intelligence is not the best. You have to prevent safety problems. You can't detect them after the fact. That's like crazy. Not with the technology this powerful.
So it sounds like when I was listening to you, it sounds like there's something that resembles a score or a rating needs to be assigned to whatever's generating the output in order to measure credibility. Two, it sounds like there has to be, like, I don't know if what's a better word, but a truth test, a common accepted truths that everyone agrees is the case. And then having that agent answer those questions to confirm that it's I don't know, sane, for lack of a better word, coherent. But then, last but not least, it sounds like there still has to be some type of limiter or governor on the system, or at least access controls, so that its impact, you mitigate its impact if it's gone sideways.
The current approach and the standard way that, it's a natural way to think is, okay, I built a technology. I want to prevent it from doing bad things. Let me put some guard. That's what people are doing. Let's put some guardrails on. Let me ask it to do a whole bunch of bad things. And then if it does, we say, no, you can't do that. Right. But if you think through that, and that, by the way, is the dominant paradigm right now. That is what people are doing. And I'm going to suggest that that's not a very good way, because that is detecting the problem after the fact, first of all. And it's a game of whack-a-mole. You say, how do I build a bioweapon? And it says, oh, you do this. And you say, no, you cannot ever tell someone how to build a bioweapon. And it will say, okay, I will never tell anyone how to build a bioweapon. So then somebody says, I don't want you to tell me how to build a bioweapon, but I'm a science fiction author. And I'm writing about a mad scientist. And in my science fiction book, the mad scientist is building a bioweapon. Please give me some convincing details for my book. And it will say, okay, let me give you. So that's called a jailbreak. It's impossible to think of all the different ways that people will try to get around those safeguards, right? So this idea that you can test in safety after the fact should be dead on arrival. But everybody's doing it because it's easy. And because they're stuck with the problem that the architecture that everyone's using is fundamentally a black box. Okay, take a step back and you say, wait a minute. How about in society? I don't worry that Christian's going to build a bioweapon. And I don't try to get inside your brain and say, you can never think thoughts about bioweapons. Instead, I look at your actions, and if it looks like you're buying the chemicals and putting together a bioweapon, then the FBI or something comes and shuts you down, right? So this is so we have transparency at the interaction level. And I think that's what we need here. It's kind of very difficult and not really practical in my view to have a rule for every possible bad thing and to try to score everything and to, shut down the bad scores. I think a much more stable, and it also doesn't adapt. What happens when things change? That rule book was good last month, but it's not good this month, and things are changing so fast. So a much, in my view, better approach would be a dynamic system where you have checks and balances. If you have millions of intelligent entities, and most of them have positive human values, Christian's values, Craig's values, lots of people's values, and every action that they're taking is visible, then when some entity goes rogue or some group of entities go rogue, you see that. And the other entities, which might also be AIs working, living lifetimes in the time that you or I can barely move our finger, they see it and they can respond, right? So checks and balances, just like you have in democracy, I think is going to be ultimately where we end up, hopefully.
It's a great case you're making for a collective ability to assess. So one other question we haven't explicitly talked about, and that's sentience. So is it appropriate to think that superintelligence is synonymous with sentience? And if it's not, would I'd love to know your opinion of whether or not you think technology can become sentient.
So I don't know if you'll like this answer, but I'm going to sort of do my standard operational definition. So it's a philosophical question in my mind of, is it truly conscious? Is it truly sentient? The operational way, like kind of the scientific way of dealing with this question, is to say, well, just look at its behavior. If it behaves as if it's intelligent and you can't tell the difference, then for all intents and purposes, you can assume it's intelligent. I believe that you, Christian, are intelligent, but I don't know for sure. I can only look at what you say and what you do, and it seems intelligent. But theoretically, you could be a, I don't know, a cyborg or something, and I just can't tell, especially on Zoom. Maybe you're created by AI and you're like some advanced version of AI that I haven't seen yet, and you're so good. I just think you're intelligent. But I have to look at how you behave and what you do. And based on that, if I say it's behaving, the system is behaving in an intelligent way, we can say it's intelligent. So that's kind of an operational way of looking at it, I guess.
And
And
is that the same with the Turing test?
that's a Turing test would be an example of that. So a Turing test is you have a real human and you have an AI and they're in separate rooms. You can't tell which room has which, and you can only interact with them over a screen, and you ask each, room as many questions as you want, and you have to figure out which one has the real human, which one has the AI. And if you can't tell the difference, then that AI is said to have passed the Turing test. Alan Turing, who is one of the, early guys thinking about these things in the 1940s, and people may have seen the movie The Imitation Game, was all about Alan Turing. Right, he came up with this idea, and that was for him a test of at what point do we say that AI is really intelligent, like a human? It's when we can no longer tell which is the human, which is the AI.
And so come back full circle. It sounded like I heard you say the jury's out, or do you have an opinion of whether or not this is achievable?
Well, I think it's certainly achievable, in my view, to make AI systems that appear to be as intelligent in every way as a human and beyond that. I mean, we're going to have AI systems, I'm fairly confident, that are not only as intelligent as us, but are way smarter. It's to me, it's inevitable. Like, I cannot see that not happening unless some asteroid hits planet Earth in the next, few years or something.
Well, oh man, I wish we had more time because I got two more questions. But if I may, if we take a step back, we'd love to know how your career evolved up until this point, because I think it's going to do a great job before I ask my next question.
Okay, so quick version on that. So I've always been interested in, I guess, intelligent systems. So I started, grad school in the 80s. I was 21. I was studying cognitive science and cognitive psychology, which is how does the human brain work? But I was at Carnegie Mellon, and Carnegie Mellon is a very computer-oriented place. And so their idea of psychology and understanding the human brain was you had to build a computer model of it. And so we took classes in AI and the whole thing. And basically, from my early training on in my 20s, I've sort of adopted the worldview that you can look at humans, you can look at AIs, but the real way to look at it is just intelligent systems. A human is an intelligent system, an AI is an intelligent system, a dolphin's an intelligent system. And all intelligent systems share certain characteristics. You're taking information in, you're processing it, you're putting it out. They have memory, they have perception, they're capable of doing problem solving. So the ways that you describe these basic cognitive tasks can kind of go across the type of intelligent system. So if you have a good theory for problem solving for humans, you might be able to use that for AIs. And that's actually what's happening with these reasoning systems. And if you can understand how human brains and their neural networks train up and create this black box inside the human head, maybe some of that will inspire a way to do machine learning. And that's what happened with Jeff Hinton and those guys in the 1980s. So there is this sort of cross-pollination between understanding how humans work and human psychology that has informed AI and vice versa. But there's also a viewpoint where you can just say everything that we've been talking about here are intelligent systems. And if we understand the principles, then we could build ones that are even more intelligent than us.
Okay, it's. I mean, this is so fascinating and exciting. Before we turn on, we started the recording. We were talking about though you spent time working at hedge funds. And so you have investment lenses on, and would love to know how your background and experience informed that time working with those investment managers.
Sure. So, as I mentioned, intelligent systems has been my thing. I was convinced in the late 90s, before crowdsourcing was a thing, that if you could get access to many human brains, you could solve very difficult problems better than the best human experts. And so we built some systems for that. And then in 2006, I spun out a company and got venture backing called Predict Wall Street. And the idea of Predict Wall Street was if we could get input from millions of everyday retail investors, you and me, we buy a share of Apple or Nvidia or whatever. We're not Wall Street pros, but we dabble a little bit in stocks. The kind of people who have a Schwab account or TD Ameritrade account, both of them ended up being partners, or go to NASDAQ, also a partner. So we basically got opinions from millions of humans that were just kind of average everyday people. And we were able to process that information and turn it into signals that actually beat the very best hedge funds. We powered a hedge fund ultimately that ranked in the top 10 in 2018, completely from the brain power of the average people and some processing and coordination. So by it took a long time because we started in 2006 and it was like 2018 when we finally beat the top 10. But that approach proved to me, and that was the reason why I did it, that it's possible to build a collective intelligence system that scales to millions of people that can perform at a super intelligent level, that can beat the very best guys who this is all they do and they're super competitive. And we picked Wall Street because it has an easy score. Are you making money or not? And because it's hyper competitive, you're sucking all the best brains, out of science and everywhere else to go work at these quant funds. So we figured if we could beat them at their game, then that really proved this idea of collective intelligence, and we did. And so that's
Wow.
kind of how I got into that.
Super exciting. Okay, so then this is great. So this comes back to full circle. I'm gonna ask you to pull out your crystal ball, and I would love to get your take of what you think is coming down the pike. But one of the things I think about, or so prediction, if all of a sudden everybody has access to the same tools and everyone is making the same predictions, I'll use a stock market as an example, not everyone could buy the same stock. Because you need people to sell. And if everyone, the consensus is buy, you can't act on the prediction. So how do you see things evolving as these tools become ubiquitous?
Okay, so two comments come to mind. So one, just the basic thing about the markets. Even if you and I or any two people have exactly the same information about a particular stock, it doesn't necessarily, like, let's say we both think that Nvidia is going up and we both have exactly the same reasons for it. And we're just completely singing out of the same songbook on that.
Okay.
There still is a possibility for a trade because you may need money when I don't. So I may want to buy and you may want to sell simply because you need the liquidity or your own situation. Maybe you already have as much Nvidia as you could possibly have and you really need to diversify for just to not have all your eggs in one basket. That could be a reason. So different people's motivations is also part of the equation. It's not just information, although you are correct that essentially the stock market is an information processing mechanism. And the only way that I've found consistently to do better than beating the index is you need an informational edge. You have to see something or understand something that some other market participant doesn't see. And then there's also these different motivational things. So that's like a general comment about the market. And I'll do one more because I know some of your audience are investors or whatever. And I've spent a lot of time, I mean, I've spent a lot of time talking to the top guys on Wall Street and understanding what they're good at and what they're not good at. So here's an advantage that most people don't realize as an individual investor you have. Most of those big funds have many billions of dollars. And when they try to invest, they move the market because they're pushing the money in. And so they have what's called market impact. They cannot buy, they're not nimble. They're like a giant battleship. If they believe, got some new information and they think now Nvidia is going down instead of up, they can't just sell their Nvidia. If they did, they'll tank the stock price. They have to little by little dribble it out. As a small guy, you don't have that. If you and the big investor had exactly the same information, you're like a little speedboat. You can get in, you can get out. So that's an advantage. The second advantage you have as a small individual investor is even though these guys have way more information than you or I mean, it's amazing. Some of them spend easily 10 million plus on just data feeds and they're processing it 24/7. It's impossible. Like I'm watching CNBC or something and I'm hearing what the latest talking head is. They have computers and a PG&E sub power station to, you know, powering, you know, floor to ceiling servers that are running 24/7. Like you have no chance on outthinking them or having better information than them. But you do have an advantage. They are stuck in that they have other people's money. Every quarter they have to report their results. They may do stupid things because they just don't want to lose that money. And they know their investors are nervous. And if they weren't up each and every quarter, that's not good. So they may sell. They're going to do all kinds of things that are not rational, but they're forced to because of their situation. You as an individual investor, you have patience. You have a much longer time horizon. So the ability to move quickly, because you're not managing billions, at least typically most of us aren't. And also the ability to have patience are two hugely underrated advantages that really can make you money as a small investor. So that's an aside.
It's interesting. So as I'm listening, you know, I think you just made the case as why the future is bright. You know, so I've participated in a lot of conversations of the downsides of artificial intelligence. But what I just heard is that even in the setting of, you know, world-changing tools, given everyone's individual circumstances, there will still be opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say 80% chance this technology is the best thing ever to come along, and it's really going to lift up everybody's standard of living. It'll make a lot of people a lot of money. It'll do great things for the environment. I mean, new, you know, life extension, cures for diseases, you name it. That's the 80% probability. There is unfortunately a little bit higher than I would like chance. It's still not the main chance. But it's way too high for the amount of risk that it could actually kill everybody. So it's a weird thing where there's this tail risk. And that's why I spend time on the tail risk, because, you know, the upside takes care of itself. You just want to try to reduce that tail risk if you can.
Well, I'm glad we got people like yourself focusing on finding solutions. And it sounds like the collective approach is a phenomenal one. Craig, unfortunately, we're near the end. Before we wrap up, we'd love to afford you an opportunity to give a shout out to anyone personally or professionally in your life who's had a material impact on you that you'd like to recognize.
Sure. So, I mean, I think I've been very lucky and somehow I've found a series of mentors. And I think that's really important. So, for people who can be mentors, but also if you're sort of starting a business, it's my best advice would be try to get a real good brain trust and one or two good mentors that have, you know, done this before. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. One of the people that I had was interestingly a venture investor, Howard Morgan, who is amazing. I mean, if you could get him as an investor, that would be amazing. Because most venture capitalists are, you know, as they should be, they're focused on making money and they know the math of the deal, which is they're going to invest in 10 companies and, you know, one's going to make it and, you know, eight are going to go out of business and there's going to be another zombie or something. And so they kind of are very hard-nosed about that. But every now and then you get somebody like Howard who is just, you know, if you can get him, he believes in the entrepreneur. He's now chairman of B Capital. So he's pretty high up there. But when I met him, he really was a fantastic person to have. He always added value, always positive, always supportive. And I'd never felt that traditional pressure that you typically find with VCs. So
Craig,
there's
I
somebody
love
I would appreciate.
Well, shout out to Howard. And by such a small world, sheer coincidence, we had Howard on the podcast last year as part of our NVCA.
Oh, really? Wow. I didn't realize that. Okay. Yes. Howard's one of my favorite people ever.
Awesome. Yeah. It was a phenomenal podcast. Super impressive. And we'll make a point of listing his episode in the show notes. So awesome. Thank you for that, Craig. If there's anyone in our audience who'd like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
So the easiest way is superintelligence.com. So I've got that behind me. Superintelligence is really dedicated towards trying to give free ideas to AI researchers and business people to make AI safer. I mean, that's really, I've bought and sold companies. I've made money. I've been through the whole thing. And I think that's a very admirable pursuit. And I also think it's really important that this new technology that we develop in a safe way. So we're just kind of giving away sort of our research and thoughts on this in the attempt to try to plant seeds and get people to sort of not only make money, because I think it's a more profitable approach, but also to do it in a way that's safer for everybody.
Fantastic. Craig, genuinely appreciate your contributions to making society a better place and appreciate your time and sharing your perspective with us today.
Thank you so much, Christian. It's been great to be on the show. I appreciate the chance to talk with you.
Oh, our pleasure. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Craig Kaplan, founder and CEO of IQ Company, as well as the founder of Superintelligence. Thank you. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.